Our star guest today began his musical career in the classical genre, but has gone on to embrace opera, jazz, and even prog rock. Ben Jones relocated to New York City from San Francisco in 2019. His performing career was already established after 6 years with Grammy Award-winning vocal ensemble Chanticleer. But a new start in the Big Apple has led to even greater things. Ben's been working with some of the world's leading singers and musicians. And not only that, but he's the cover star of the current edition of International Cabaret Scenes magazine. I think it's time we met him. Ben Jones, welcome to Community Connections and Read on the Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
I had to laugh. We'd set this interview up about a day before Cabaret Scenes magazine landed on my letterbox, and I thought, that's quite handy. Ben, it's quite a thing, really, to get on the cover of this internationally acclaimed magazine. Let's start from that perspective. How does it feel?
It feels great. It was such a surprise. I think they contacted me just after the Cabaret convention this year. I had been a last minute addition to the convention cast list anyway, so all the more surprising to be asked to do an interview, and then to find out I'd be on the cover. That was pretty great.
Let's go right back to the beginning. You were born into quite a musical family, weren't you?
Yes, absolutely. My folks were both professional violinists, my siblings and I were all to learn stringed instruments, and we had to practice before we were allowed to do our homework.
So music was very much the main part of your life growing up then, really.
I would say, I have great memories as a kid of just constant sounds of song and practice and rehearsal in the household, and always, running back and forth from one orchestral or band rehearsal to the other. It was in high school, fairly late, when I started singing, and I actually had to convince my parents that singers are musicians too.
So you did start the cello very early on, didn't you? And you were picking up brass instruments, the trumpet, the French horn. These are quite big instruments for quite a small person.
That's absolutely right. I have memories too as a kid of carrying these fairly unwieldy instruments around the hallways of the school, and even just commuting places with two things that at a certain age were almost the size of my body each. Unwieldy for sure. But quite a diverse musical upbringing, sitting sort of at certain points at the front of the orchestra in the cello section, and at other points at the very back with the horns.
Was classical music something that you'd thought you would continue with, or did you always have an urge to try and break out into something that was possibly more mainstream?
I would never say. I suppose the question sort of presupposes that by learning a new type of music, you're replacing something. At the top of the interview that I enjoy classical and theater and even prog rock. As I developed tastes in more and more styles of music, and as I continued to develop tastes in styles of music, for instance, that my kids enjoy now that I wouldn't have any exposure to except that they bring it into the house. It's not that those things are replacing classical music or any other style. It's sort of, adding to the toolkit, so to speak. For instance, as I started to develop a love for musical theater, again, fairly late, I was almost 20 years old. It's not that that replaced classical music, although in my parents' eyes, certainly I was spending less time with classical music. It's just that it sort of, enriches a bigger love for all kinds of music.
You took a family decision, didn't you, to move from San Francisco to New York? That was a decision you made with your partner at the time. Before you left San Francisco, you did spend many years with Grammy Award-winning vocal ensemble. How did that start?
Oh wow. Well, I went to San Francisco. I was raised in the Midwest, and I arrived in San Francisco to do my master's degree at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, which is now in the same neighborhood as the symphony and the opera, and at the time as the rehearsal spaces that Chanticleer used. And so I was having lunch at the same restaurants that these guys were, and I came to know them. And I would go and sing for them once a year because they hold yearly auditions, whether or not there are openings. And it was fairly clear to me that there never would be an opening for my voice part because the gentleman who sang in chair 8 and had for more than a decade, was essentially never going to leave. And then one year, the music director, Joe Jennings, retired after more than 30 years, I believe, as the music director of the group. And this gentleman who sang in chair eight became the director of the ensemble. And thus his chair was vacated. And so very quickly, I was alerted by multiple members of the ensemble, hey, be ready. It's time. At the time, I had just finished my master's. I was conducting the San Jose Youth Symphony, and I was performing in a show in San Francisco called Beach Blanket Babylon. And on the one hand, it was a joyous occasion. It was also a very sad time because in a matter of days, I had to quit a whole bunch of engagements, you know, those two sort of regular things, in addition to about 2 years worth of bookings, you know, where I was going to be traveling around the US and around the world to do solo gigs. But I was happy to do so because Chanticleer had been a dream, you know, since I was a kid.
You arrived then in New York City, totally different to San Francisco. How did you find re-establishing yourself there, or did you have contacts there that could help you once you arrived?
It was incredibly difficult. I did have contacts, and I had a team of mostly conductors who had been hiring me with professional symphony orchestras around the States, who wanted to connect me with people in New York. But the timing was terrible. I mean, when we arrived in New York, it was just in time for the pandemic to shut everything down. In fact, I had a whole bunch of bookings in Europe. A few operas with the English National Opera, and then some solo concert gigs booked in Poland and Russia and other parts of the EU, all of which were canceled when the pandemic happened. At that time, I was trying to find an apartment in London. My wife and I were going to try to figure out how to split our time between New York and London. And my son was born just in the midst of all of that. I mean, the silver lining was that I got to be there for the birth, which I was going to probably miss because of those ENO contracts. But yeah, essentially the story is it was an incredibly difficult couple of years trying to establish myself in the midst of the pandemic and sort of in the midst of pivoting from this opera career that was sort of blossoming across the pond over where you are, and trying to figure out how to make my way in New York instead.
I guess in a way that during the pandemic, the clubs in New York ostensibly were able to stay open because they were serving food. And you sort of came up with quite a unique way of funding yourself to try and get your performances out there to try and minimize the impact of the pandemic. Tell us about that.
Well, that's right. Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, what I found when the pandemic shut everything down were that there were these stages in New York that were still open, and it's because they had been deemed essential businesses. I don't know if you used the same term
We
in the
did.
UK, but yeah, it was because, like you said, they had kitchens attached, and so they were deemed essential, and so they stayed open, and many of the performers had left New York. And so these stages were hungry for anyone who could sing a song, basically. And so I started to perform in the basement clubs of New York, which was new to me. I had not to that point really performed in such small venues where you're so close to the audience. And I met a music director, Ron Abel, who very quickly we you know the literally the first time that we performed together, we looked at each other and, you know, essentially said, who are you? Who is this person? And we never looked back. We've been touring together ever since. And very quickly I came to understand that he's not only a great accompanist and a great musician, but also a great arranger and band leader. And to your point, you know, having a band with you on stage is not an inexpensive endeavor. And so I sort of looked around, and I first got my head around what it costs to have a band on stage. You know, if you're gonna, it's essentially $1,000 US to put a band around you on stage on any given night in a club. And so I started a GoFundMe, and I went out to my supporters, my email list, my social media followers, and started to say, "Hey, look, it's a pandemic. I'm still performing. I'm here for you. If you feel safe, please come out." And what I'd like to do as we tour around the U.S. and as that tour schedule started to pick up again, things started to open, is that I'd like to give work to musicians in your cities, in your local markets. And the only way I can do that, because this is no way to make a living, is to raise money. And people came out of the woodwork and gave that, but they said thank you for the opportunity. I heard from so many people that I've known for the longest time, who love to give time and money and resources to things like the orchestra and the opera and the nonprofits in town, but they also look for ways to support independent artists and individuals, and they thanked me profusely for simply for asking. They would say we were always looking for ways to support and we never know how, so thank you. And over the years, I've raised tens of thousands of dollars on GoFundMe. I at least 10,000 a year for the last 5 years just for touring expenses and for hiring local musicians. Ron and I never take any of that money. It goes to paying the musicians, it goes to getting them to the venues, it goes to rentals and transportation costs for those musicians. Sometimes, we'll take musicians from Chicago, for instance, and take them around the Midwest. And that's expensive. But those folks wouldn't have that work if it weren't for my supporters. And so, I'll forever be grateful to them.
I suspect also back in the days of the pandemic, there were so few performances going on that maybe it attracted new people to cabaret. People that perhaps wouldn't have considered it before, but thought, actually, this is going on. Let's go and see what we think, and then stuck with it.
I think you're absolutely right, and I'm laughing because I was new to cabaret. I had no idea that the art form existed, and I suppose that sounds like an overstatement, but it's not. I had seen people do cabaret, but I didn't know what it was called. I had seen Rita Moreno do her one-woman show. I had seen other people who came through the Bay Area or who lived there do what I now understand are one man, one woman or cabaret shows where they sing songs and talk a little bit. And I had even grown up seeing touring musicians come through the Civic Center in Peoria and do cabaret in the Symphony Hall. And so, honestly, I started touring with Ron and doing this thing without really understanding anything about the art form. Ron encouraged me to sort of talk a little bit about myself or about my life or about my whatever I was thinking in between songs. And as I started doing that, I understood, okay, this is something that people like. And it was only then that I went and started to see my friends doing what they're doing in the cabaret world in New York and outside of New York. And I started to understand, oh, this is an art form with a rich history and tradition. And then I went on to inform myself and to understand, okay, well, here's what I didn't know. But you're absolutely right. I mean, many of my own followers from the Bay Area, people who, whether they were supporters from when I was performing with the Symphony or with Chanticleer or Beach Blanket Babylon or students, former students of mine from the San Jose Youth Symphony, those people would come to the clubs and they still do. I'm going back to San Francisco in just a few weeks to perform at the Nikko. And I have such a friendly crowd there, and many of those people were not cabaret fans before the pandemic. I can't take all the credit. I think to your point, probably those stages being the only thing available in many of the cities around the world drew people to those live performances because it was people were hungry for arts and culture during that time, and I feel very fortunate to have been a part of providing that where I could.
Let's come bang up to date then, if we can, Ben. And you've been working recently with Lawrence Hopgood, the virtuoso pianist. There's an album that's been released as well. What a wonderful opportunity to work with such a player.
Well, you're absolutely right. He's incredible. No one plays like Lawrence. No one listens like Lawrence. It's incredibly intimidating because Without getting too much in the weeds here, you know, I can do something like back phrasing, which many singers understand is a very tasteful thing to do in jazz and cabaret, where you sort of sing behind the beat a little bit. And Lawrence might sometimes hear that and think, oh, well, he's doing a 5-4 bar instead of a 4-4 bar. He's listening so acutely. He thinks I'm doing so. I have to be very deliberate. I have to be very, very demonstrative when I'm doing things like this. But he's an incredible musician. We found, well, first of all, we started to work together just because I called him. We had met a few times, and I called him to say, "Hey, I have this date booked at Birdland in New York City, and I don't have anyone to play it with. Who should I call?" And Lawrence paused for a moment and said, "What about me?" And so we just started performing together. And very quickly people said, "Hey, this ought to be recorded," and people got behind it. And very similarly to my touring fundraising, we raised over $50,000 last year to record and release that album and promote it. And people have responded. So Lawrence and I are still touring. He's who I'm playing with in San Francisco in a couple weeks, and more dates to come throughout the year. And you know, we're expanding our repertoire, doing of course jazz, but now some Americana, plenty of musical theater. Lawrence has a background, a love of musical theater. His father was the head of multiple theater departments at universities throughout the United States. And you know, when we got together that first time just to talk through what kind of music we each enjoy, we found all that common ground, all that love for Broadway and you know, classical upbringing. He studied classical piano with the same teachers that taught my sister. She was a pianist from a very young age, and Lawrence and I both went to the same university. We went to the University of Illinois. So lots in common. And I'm just so happy that he and I have found ways to collaborate and to tour together, and glad that the album is reaching people.
On the subject of touring, Ben, do you have any plans to come over to the UK at any time soon?
I would love to. You know, we had dates booked a couple of years ago at the Pheasantry in London, and we were trying to add to that, and then I can't remember what it was. A scheduling problem arose, and so we postponed those dates that I had around Europe, and then we never solidified new dates. So I need to get back on that. I would love to get over to the UK and the EU and get back there. I was in Norway and Germany in October, but that's not enough. I want to see more of Europe more regularly. So,
We want you over here in the UK, that's for sure. Ben, how can my
absolutely.
listeners find out more information about you?
My website is benjonessinger.com. All my tour dates are there. And you can find me at Ben Jones Singer on all the social platforms, as much as you like.
That's where you need to go. We will finish off in a few moments' time with a wonderful recording of yours from a live performance at 54 Below a couple of years ago, hopelessly devoted to you. Yes, normally sung by a lady, but this is a wonderful version of the song.
Wow, I'm so pleased that you're playing that. This was an idea of Ron Abel's. He has wild off the wall ideas sometimes, and this was one. He said, "You know, we ought to pay tribute to Olivia Newton-John. She had passed recently at the time. This was a couple of years back, and we were looking for a song." And he said, "What about this one? You know, this was her iconic song, and I just love performing it with him. I'm so glad that you're going to play it for your audience."
It certainly suits your voice, and your take on it is slightly different, but a real tribute to Olivia Newton-John. Ben Jones, thank you so much for joining us from New York City. Can I wish you all the best, particularly for your upcoming trip back to San Francisco? And as and when you've got things coming up, come back on, particularly if there's a hint you might be coming to London.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
Guess mine was not the first heartbroken. My eyes were not the first to cry. I'm not the first to know. There's just no getting over you. I know I'm just a fool who's willing to sit around and wait for you. But baby, can't you see? There's nothing left for me to do. I'm hopelessly devoted to you. But now there's nowhere to hide. Since you pushed my love aside, I'm out of my head. Hopelessly devoted to you. Oh, hopelessly devoted to you. I'm hopelessly devoted to you. My head is saying, just forget her. My heart is saying, don't let go. Just hold on to the end, and it's just what I intend to do. I'm hopelessly devoted to you. Come on, sing along with me. Come on. But now there's nowhere to hide. Since you pushed my love aside, I'm out of my head. Hopelessly devoted to you. Oh, I'm hopelessly devoted to you.
Recorded live at 54 Below in New York City, today's star guest, Ben Jones, with Hopelessly Devoted to You.